This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Joseph Wilson, was the acting ambassador to Iraq in 1990, just before the Gulf War, when Iraq invaded Kuwait. He thinks that war was justified. But he thinks President George W. Bush manipulated intelligence last year to make the case for invading Iraq. Wilson challenged this now-famous 16-word statement that the president made in his 2003 State of the Union address, quote, "The British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa," unquote. Wilson had earlier written a report for the CIA that found no evidence supporting that claim. He challenged the president's statement in a New York Times op-ed piece titled, "What I Didn't Find in Africa." After the publication, it was leaked to the press that Wilson's wife worked as an undercover CIA agent. The information was published in a piece by Robert Novak. Wilson believes the leak came from someone in the Bush administration. Wilson has written a new memoir called The Politics of Truth. Earlier this week, we recorded an interview about the leak and about his experiences as acting ambassador to Iraq. I asked him, if the Bush administration wanted to seek revenge on him, why would they blow his wife's cover?
Well, actually, I've always believed that her cover was blown as a means of intimidating others and discouraging others from coming forward and sharing their stories about the pressures they might have felt or the anomalies in the way that the intelligence was presented. It was only after a Washington Post article quoted a senior administration official as saying it was revenge that reason kind of entered into the public debate.
If someone in the Bush administration wanted to punish you, why would they blow the cover of your wife, which is a kind of indirect way of getting to you while at the same time really hurting her, when she hadn't done anything that opposed what the administration was saying? Why not find a way to get something that would make you personally look bad?
Well, and there are many things that they might have been able to find about me that would have made me look bad. It's a little bit more difficult, however, since it was this president's father who made me an ambassador and this president's father who called me a hero when I came back from Baghdad the first time. And because I'm not such a, at that time certainly was not seen to be a highly partisan figure. I think the line of argument that they were trying to make was that somehow my wife was responsible for sending me over there to Niger in the first place, and therefore this was some nepotism. And as a consequence, whether or not the 16 words or the assertion was true or not, they wanted to change the subject by insinuating that somehow my wife had done something unethical, which, of course, both the CIA and the White House have now acknowledged wasn't true.
That this was some kind of nepotism, like, oh you need
right.
to send somebody to Africa, send my husband.
Send my husband. By the way, don't pay him for 2 weeks and leave me at home with my 2-year-old twins. But we'll do that because it's a good thing to do. It's nepotism. After all, Niger is such a garden spot of West Africa. I mean, that was the line of argument.
Do I hear a little bit of cynicism?
Yeah, more than a little bit. It was a dumb thing for them to do, quite apart from being the illegal.
Washington is a tough place, but have you ever heard of anything like this happening?
Well, people have been in Washington for far longer than I have been. Have told me that this is the first time in anybody's memory that a CIA operative has been exposed by her own government.
Have you asked yourself, if this information was leaked to a journalist, why would a journalist want to release it? In this case, it was Bob Novak who was the first to make it public.
Well, that's right. And Mr. Novak, in one of his many explanations, all of which are different, has argued that he was not party to that first leak, that he got his information independently. What I have said repeatedly is that as a former officer of the government of the United States, I swore an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution, and part of that is to defend the freedom of the press. So I don't begrudge Novak having printed the article. The questions I have for Novak are, what part of no didn't you understand when you spoke to the CIA and they said not to print it? And what really did the inclusion of my wife's name add to the story? Because if you go back and you read his article, it doesn't add anything. It was just gratuitous, to say the least.
There is a law against revealing who is an undercover CIA and blowing CIA agent blowing their cover. So what are the penalties for doing this?
Well, there are a number of laws. The one that people most frequently cite is the Intelligence Identification Protection Act, and I believe the it's a felony. I know it's a felony, and I believe it's punishable by 10 years in jail and a significant fine. But Sam Dash, the Georgetown law professor and former Watergate counsel, and he was also an ethics advisor at Ken Starr, has also argued that this may have been a violation of the Patriot Act as well. We will just see under what law they might be able to prosecute these people.
What's the state of the investigation into this now?
Well, it's really in the hands of the FBI and the special counsel, and I have absolute confidence in both. I think they're doing everything they can. The fact that we haven't been able to bring this to closure yet after 9 months, I think, is a reflection of the stonewalling that's going on in the White House. But I think that they will be able to do to come to some conclusion. I think they have a pretty good idea of what happened. The question is whether or not they'll be able to prosecute. And as I like to point out, irrespective of whether they can bring this to prosecution, the minute the CIA referred it to the Justice Department for investigation, that was an indication to the government that, in the judgment of the CIA, the national security of the country had been breached by this act. In other words, it was at that point that the two people who had leaked became what the first George Bush called the most insidious of traitors. So it doesn't matter if they can be prosecuted, they're still the most insidious of traitors.
What is your latest theory of who outed your wife?
Well, based on what people have told me who were close to the White House and who have heard from sources within the White House, what happened was in March of 2003, at the time or shortly after I appeared on CNN and said that I thought the government knew about this business of uranium from Niger than it was letting on, there was a meeting held in the offices of the vice president, chaired by probably Scooter Libby, the vice president's chief of staff, at which a decision was made to do what they called a workup, which is essentially run an intelligence operation against an American citizen, against me, to try and find out everything they could about me, about my wife, about my family, about my past, in order to have some ammunition to discredit me if I attempted to call the government to account on what was clearly a deceptive statement in the State of the Union address.
Now, Louis Libby works for Vice President Cheney, and it was Cheney who asked the CIA, you say, to investigate the charge that Iraq had bought uranium from Africa.
Actually, Mr. Cheney acknowledged that in an interview he did with Tim Russert on Meet the Press, that he asked the question. And that was that question, is there anything to this allegation that led the CIA to look into it? And as I point out to everybody who will listen, mine was only one of three reports on this particular subject. Another report was submitted by a four-star Marine Corps general and a third report by the U.S. ambassador on the scene. And all three of us concluded that this was the allegation was just not correct, was not accurate.
So you're saying that the vice president's office, which initiated the idea that somebody should go to Africa to investigate this charge that Iraq bought uranium from Africa, that after initiating this kind of investigation, the vice president's office didn't like the answer that you gave and decided to blow your wife's cover as retribution and as a warning to others. Were you going to say something there?
Well, I was going to say that the vice president said, is there anything to this allegation? The CIA, in response to that, sent me and other agencies looked into it. Everybody came back and said there's nothing to the allegation. Notwithstanding that, the assertion ended up in the State of the Union address. And when I challenged the government, when I held my government to account for what it had said to the Congress of the United States and the American people, and after the government, the White House, had acknowledged that the accuracy of my assertion, then the vice president or his office or somebody close to the president and the vice president decided that that the way of getting even would be to go after me. Now, I had always assumed that it was to discourage others, but it's sort of a senior administration official who has said it was to get even revenge.
Was there any attempt to direct you when you were sent to Niger to investigate the charges that Iraq bought uranium there? Were there any suggestions that the answer you should find is yes, they did, and that helps make a convincing case for war in Iraq? Were you directed in any way?
No, I was not. But in my dealings with the U.S. government prior to and after my trip, when I first came back, was at the technical level. I think everybody understood this to be a very serious question being asked by a serious and very senior official in the U.S. government for the purposes, really, of national security. As I remind people, atomic bombs don't kill just Republicans or Democrats. They kill Americans. This is a true national security issue. And the question needed to be looked at objectively, which is what I did, and which was what all the analysts who I spoke to before and after I came back wanted to be done. I think it was only at the political level that that the insertion of the 16 words in the State of the Union became something that was that was pushed by certain people.
Now, several journalists called to warn you that your wife was going to be fair game here and her cover was going to be blown. You quote Chris Matthews, who hosts Hardball on MSNBC, as calling you and saying, "I just got off the phone with Karl Rove. He said," and I quote, "Wilson's wife is fair game." And he also said that, you know, he would back that up if he was asked. So that meant that if necessary, you could mention him by name. How did you decide whether to mention him by name or not?
Well, I'm certainly not not covered by the protection of sources provision that relates to the press. So anything that any journalist tells me, they have to assume that that I'm going to go ahead and repeat it and quote them on it. I'm not a member of the press, but I've received some phone calls actually before the Novak article appeared from Walter Pincus at the Washington Post, who called me and said, "They're coming at you, watch out." And then after the article appeared, in the week after the Novak article appeared, I began receiving phone calls from members of the press saying essentially that the White House was trying to shift the argument from the 16 words to Wilson and his wife, quote unquote. Finally, a week after the article appeared, I received this phone call from Matthews quoting Rove as saying Wilson's wife is fair game. The idea, first of all, of leaking a CIA operative's name is just abhorrent, and it is precisely what the first President Bush called the most insidious of traitors would do something like that. But even beyond that, the idea of pushing it is frankly un-American. We just don't do that in our political discourse, drag people's families into the public square just because you don't like what her husband may have said about you. I like to remind people, I didn't put the 16 words in the State of the Union. In fact, if the president had listened to me or the four-star Marine Corps general or the ambassador on the ground, he might not have put him and been in such an embarrassing position. Moreover, I did not leak the name of my wife.
The 16 words in the State of the Union address given by President Bush in January of 2003 are, "The British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa." And you, of course, wondered, well, you'd already given a report saying that that was not true, so what was that doing in the address? Where did you hear the State of the Union address? Where did you hear these 16 words?
Well, I was actually sitting in a studio. I was doing some commentary for a Canadian television program on the State of the Union address, so I heard it there. So long as the president was speaking about Africa, there was not much that I was going to say, because there are other countries in Africa that produce uranium. So it was really only in March, after the State Department had turned over documents to the International Atomic Energy Agency in compliance with the UN Security Council Resolution 1441. And then the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, a gentleman by the name of Dr. Mohamed Al-Baradei, went before the UN and said the documents relating to the purchase of uranium from Niger are not authentic. In response to that, the State Department spokesman said, "Well, we fell for it." And it was at that moment that it became apparent to me that what we were talking about was not Africa. We were talking about Niger. We were talking about a specific country about which I had very specific information.
And when you went to Niger, how could you be like 100% totally sure that Saddam Hussein had never tried to buy uranium there? Yellow cake uranium.
Well, it was what I was asked to look into was whether or not such a transaction could take place. Was it within the realm of the possible, within the realm of the feasible? Remember now, we're not talking about intent. We're talking about actual action. We're talking about something that signifies that Saddam Hussein has seriously attempted to reconstitute his nuclear weapons program, and we're talking about a U.S. government that was seized, and correctly so, with the issue of whether or not We were vulnerable to a nuclear attack from instigated from our sworn enemies. When I went out there, I looked at both the industry, because I had some familiarity with the industry, having served there in the mid-70s, and also having served as ambassador to another uranium-producing country, Gabon. I looked at the industry structure to see how easy it would be or how feasible it might be to ship 500 tons of rock, yellowcake ore, from the middle of the Sahara Desert, across the desert to the ports in West Africa, and then ultimately to a final destination without anybody knowing about it. And then I looked at the bureaucracy to determine where, how within the government structure such a decision to sell uranium to Iraq might be made, who would be involved, and what decisions would be made, what signatures would be on documents. And then finally I looked at the possibility that the coup leader in Niger, the army general who had come to power in a coup, might be able to do an off-the-books transaction with Iraq. And in all three cases, it was just simply not feasible. There were too many people who would have had to know. There are too many partners in the consortium that does the mining of uranium. And within the bureaucracy, there would have been too many places where people would have been informed in order for the documentation to proceed.
You kind of played the leak game yourself after after the president's State of the Union address, and after you were convinced that it was really Niger that the president was referring to. Instead of initially writing an article yourself or going on the talk shows yourself to talk about the fact that you found there was no evidence to back this up, you leaked it to New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. And I'm wondering, like, why you didn't want to write it yourself or say it yourself, but you wanted to give it to Kristof to anonymously, anonymously in the sense that you asked him not to mention you by name.
Sure. I mean, that's a good question. And I did it because I've been around Washington long enough, even though I'm not a Washington insider, to know that the way that one destroys the integrity of a message is to try and destroy the integrity of a messenger. And I had no particular need or desire to be the public face on this. What I wanted was that the government correct the record. It was as simple as that. And I understood that if my name were associated with it, that I would be attacked. And I wanted the message to be to have legs, basically, to have credibility before the attacks on the messenger began. I would have much preferred, frankly, if in response to the first Nick Kristof article, the U.S. government had come out and said, yeah, we really should not have put those 16 words in the State of the Union address. I never would have written my article. I would have just remained an anonymous private citizen. I did because I was not trying to hide anything from my government. The cover that the sourcing of my particular conversations with Kristof were light enough that anybody within government would have known who it was really rather easily. I wasn't trying to hide from my own government. I just didn't want the lackeys around the government who delight in the politics of personal destruction to have an easy way of getting at me.
Correct me if I'm wrong. My understanding is that in the year 2000, you contributed to both the Bush and Gore campaigns.
That's correct.
Why contribute to both sides? You're not a lobby group who's looking for tax breaks from whoever is elected. Why contribute to both
right.
sides?
Right. No, I've actually never lobbied the U.S. government. I've never contacted the U.S. government on behalf of anybody other than as a private citizen. But I have lived in dictatorships all around the world. I am from Franco, Spain, when I was a young man, to Saddam's Iraq and many African dictatorships in between. And I have served my government for 25 years and believe fervently that our democracy, for all its faults and all the little peccadilloes in it, remains the best system of governance that we have. I also fervently believe in the two-party system. And I had the means to participate in the selection of our political leaders, and I was delighted to do so. I contributed to the Bush campaign because I thought that the promise of conservative, compassionate conservatism was much more attractive than the message of Senator John McCain, then candidate McCain. I don't think that in the end I would have voted for George Bush, even if he had remained the compassionate conservative. I had known Al Gore for 15 years, and on social and domestic issues, I'm left to center. I believe in such things as a woman's right to choose, and I believe in such things as some measure of regulation on the ownership of firearms. But that said, in my voting life, I generally have voted national security concerns and issues, and have voted for candidates of both parties.
So the funding that you gave to George W. Bush was during the primary?
That's correct. I gave it to him before mm-hmm. the New Hampshire primary, in fact. And it was very clear to me after he lost New Hampshire and went to South Carolina, and they ran this this very nasty personal attack on John McCain. It was very clear to me that by tacking so far to this extreme right camp of the American body politic, that George Bush would never have my vote or my support.
You've voted Democrat, you've voted Republican in the past. You've given money to both parties. You've worked for a Democratic president, you've worked for a Republican president, for the first George Bush and for President Clinton. Since
that's right. My one political appointment that required a Senate confirmation was for President Bush. In fact, for all intents and purposes, that is my one political appointment, the first President Bush.
Now, since your wife's undercover position was blown, you've been working on the Kerry campaign, and you've worked with people from MoveOn.org, which is a group that's working hard to defeat President Bush. And I'm wondering what it's like now to... let me put it this way. Do you feel like you've changed sides, that you've become more of a partisan? And I guess what I'm really asking is, has this predicament that you've been in shaken you politically in a fundamental way?
Well, when you are a career military officer or diplomat, you go through your life, your professional life, serving the United States of America. As Wes Clark once put it, you wear U.S. on your lapel. You don't wear Republican or Democrat. And I remain an American. Now, with respect to my partisan leanings, now that I'm no longer in government and have the opportunity to participate more fully in the decisions that lead to the election of our leaders, I'm delighted to do that. And as I took that cold, hard look at the whole range of issues that were important to me, and where I fit within the political spectrum, I come increasingly down on the Democratic side of the ledger. Now, that's not to say I'm not for strong defense. I am. I'm also for smart defense, and I'm also for strong diplomacy. And I believe, frankly, that there are things that the Democrats do far better in the interests of the United States, and far more consistent with some of the basic tenets of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, which are our founding documents.
You are, as a former ambassador, you represented your country in Iraq, and you also were a diplomat in several African countries. As you say, you wore the U.S. on your lapel, not Democrat or Republican. What is your reaction as somebody who has represented the United States abroad diplomatically to the prison abuse scandal in Iraq?
Well, I mean, it goes far beyond the prison abuse scandal. I think that this administration has essentially turned on its head everything that I worked for 25 years in the U.S. government, the notion of promoting democratization, freedom, human rights, all those things that we worked on, rule of law. The prison abuse scandal is appalling. Whatever little credibility still remained for the United States after all we've done over the past 3 years has eroded badly. And the idea that the administration continues to waffle and wring its hands and not do something decisive every hour that we don't do something decisive to ensure that there is some political accountability is an hour that we lose in the fight to regain what I think is our natural status as one of the world's great leaders.
What do you think your diplomatic counterparts today are up against now?
Well, I think just by virtue of what we've done in Iraq, and even before the prison abuse, I think that we have made this a much more dangerous world for the next generation of diplomats and military leaders. I think we have added to the terrorism problem dramatically. I think one of the things that will come out of this is you will see the hatred of the United States grow exponentially throughout the Arab world. And from that that larger pool of people who dislike us will be drawn a greater number of 19-year-old underemployed or unemployed Arab males who think that their way to their destiny is to do harm to us and our interests.
What do you think the Bush administration should do now to show the world that it finds what happened in Abu Ghraib abhorrent?
Well, I think there's a number of things that need to be done immediately. One, President Bush should fire Don Rumsfeld. He should not be permitted to resign. He should be asked to resign.
Why do you make that distinction?
Well, because I don't think that Don Rumsfeld should be permitted the luxury of leaving office. I think there needs to be a certain amount of censure. That's what political accountability is all about. You have to ask him for his resignation. And the political chain of command for this goes right up to the Secretary of Defense. And I say that as somebody who has little time for his deputy secretary, Paul Wolfowitz, who I think has been the architect of an absolute foreign policy disaster. But I do think the political accountability requires that the Secretary of Defense be fired. In addition to that, I think that we should make public the reports of the International Red Cross that apparently have been given to us since late last year. I think that having demonstrated that we're incapable of ensuring the respect for the dignity of those people who are detained under our command, one of the things that we should do to restore some semblance of credibility is have far greater participation of both the International Red Cross and the International Red Crescent in prisons and detention centers, and not just in Iraq, but also in Afghanistan and Guantanamo, where we're operating outside the confines of the Geneva Convention. I think that's a minimal amount of things that we can do to demonstrate that we're serious about being accountable for our own actions. Beyond that, I frankly think that this administration's foreign and defense policy is bankrupt and needs to be put into receivership, and that we need a wholesale change in the Defense Department and the bringing back into government of serious Republicans from past administrations or even current administrations. Rich Armitage, for example, in my mind, would be a good replacement for Mr. Rumsfeld during this period from now until the end of the electoral season.
And is Donald Rumsfeld the only person who you think should lose his job over the prison scandal?
No, I've said in my book, actually, I think that we could change the foreign policy of this country by firing fewer than 20 people. Now, in the case of the prison abuse, I think Rumsfeld is the one who satisfies the political accountability question. And this is not a partisan. This is not Joe Wilson, a partisan Democrat, speaking. This is Joe Wilson as somebody who understands that the political scandal that has been generated because of these pictures is of global consequence to our national security and our national interests. And in order to stem the bleeding, there has to be political accountability shown to the world. And Mr. Rumsfeld is the candidate for that.
But there's 19 other people who you think should be departing.
Yeah, I say that. I mean, up to 19, we could probably do with a few less. But that's in the foreign policy arena. And basically, as I point out, it's everybody who signed the Project for the New American Century, people who signed into this idea that the best way to deal with the Middle East was to invade, conquer, and occupy Iraq.
Is President Bush one of the people you would like to see leave?
Well, I have to tell you, with respect to the president and the vice president, I think one of the most distressing things over the past 10 years has been the cheapening of the constitutional process. When the impeachment hearings for President Clinton, for private peccadilloes, the short-circuiting of the electoral process in California that led to the defeat of Gray Davis, all of those, I think, debase our constitutional process. So with respect to the president and the vice president, I think that the way we deal with this is at the ballot box. This is an electoral question. The president himself has said that that he wants to run on his record, and as well, I think he should. And I think the voters will take care of that.
My guest is Joseph Wilson. His new memoir is called The Politics of Truth. You've been opposed to this war in Iraq, and you certainly don't think it has turned out very well. Right before the first Gulf War, you were the deputy chief of mission at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, and then you became the acting ambassador there after April Glaspie left, shortly before Iraq invaded Kuwait. So you were there from 88 to early 91?
That's correct. I left on January 12, 1991, about 3 days before the bombing of Baghdad.
When you started in Iraq, when you started working in the embassy there, was Saddam Hussein still considered an ally of the United States?
Well, I don't think Saddam Hussein was ever considered an ally. He was a force in the region. Our position towards the Iran-Iraq war was really, I think, generated as much by a desire not to see the Iranians overrun Iraq as it was any sort of feeling for Saddam Hussein. Our relations, and as I wrote the book, I went back and reviewed all of this, and it became clear to me in reviewing it with the passage of time and distance that the nature of our policy was very almost schizophrenic towards Iraq. On the one hand, we were interested in promoting a better trading relationship in the hopes that the political benefits that would come from that would be a more moderate Iraq. On the other hand, there was a lot of evidence of continued human rights abuses of the worst kind that forced us to be, I think, really tough on the Iraqis, or try to be tough on the Iraqis to get them to change their behavior. So it's easily understood how the Iraqis might have been confused about what we were about. But in essence, we believed that that by promoting dialogue and by promoting commercial exchanges that would benefit the anchor of Iraqi society, its businesses and its business people, that we might have a positive influence on the behavior of Saddam Hussein. Clearly, that was wrong, but that was what drove the policy in those days. At the same time, we were pretty clear-eyed about the nature of the human rights abuses, and the human rights reports that we wrote during those 3 years were pretty damning of the and reflective, really, of the situation there.
You were the last American to meet with Saddam Hussein before the war started. You met with him on August 6, 1990. This was 4 days after Iraq invaded Kuwait. You met with him for nearly 2 hours. In your book, you describe getting photographed with Saddam Hussein just before you sat down to talk with him. You were very conscious of how you wanted to appear on camera. What was your concern?
Well, by the way, in the way that I look at the first Gulf War, the war really started with his invasion of Kuwait. Desert Storm was the counterattack, but the Gulf War really began with Saddam's invasion of Kuwait. But with respect to the photograph and how one is projected to the world, speaking to Saddam's people and then subsequently to the world, Saddam very clearly set himself up in a position where he tried to exude superiority and omnipotence in these meetings. And one of the images that he wanted to portray to his people was of foreign visitors bowing to the potentate. And one of the ways that he did that was hold his hand unnaturally low for the handshake, thereby forcing the guest to bend over to see the hand, lest you grab another part of his anatomy. So when I met him in that last meeting, I just stared straight ahead and just groped until I found his hand.
If Saddam wore a gun during your conversation with him, do you think that was for show?
Well, we used to always kid about the necessity on the part of some of these senior leaders to wear guns as they were in civilians. He didn't have much to fear from me. He had his bodyguards with him and everything. But it was very clearly a symbol for him as he projected his leadership and his authority to his people.
And you say that after your conversation, he took off the gun and said that it was actually very uncomfortable.
Yeah, about halfway through the conversation, after the cameras had left, then he reached down to his gun, and my initial thought was, oh, did I say something I shouldn't have said there? But it was really just the belt and the gun. They took it off and put it on the table next to him.
What did you want to accomplish?
But he had, he had a reputation of having personally executed ministers in his cabinet and of having used the gun on people within his government.
So it didn't feel real comfortable to have him wearing it while you were talking, I guess.
I didn't feel real comfortable when he went for it.
Right. What did you hope to accomplish during that conversation with him, and what was it like to talk to somebody who you think is a sociopath?
Well, this was the first time in the 2.5 years that I'd been there that we'd had a one-on-one conversation. I had accompanied the ambassador and other visitors into other meetings, but this was the first time. I had not slept for 4 days. While I did not have any talking points from the Department of State, the 3 points that I wanted to make were: get out of Kuwait now. You're in violation of the UN Charter, the Arab League Charter, your own draft constitution. Quit intimidating American diplomats down there, and quit looting American properties, and allow all foreigners to leave the region at a time of instability. He had closed all the borders and was not allowing people to leave. From his perspective, what he wanted to tell me was, we're going to stay in Kuwait. The al-Sabah family, the ruling family of Kuwait, is, quote, history, unquote. And if you don't try and throw us out militarily, we'll guarantee you a steady supply of oil at a decent price. And by the way, we won't continue to invade. We won't continue on the way to Saudi Arabia, and will not invade Saudi Arabia unless the Saudis allow their territory to be used as a way of destabilizing our regime. So those were the basic outlines. Let us keep Kuwait, and we'll give you oil. He then went on to say that should you try and throw us out militarily, you will suffer the spilling of the blood of 10,000 of your soldiers in the Arabian Desert, and you don't have the political will to absorb that.
What were some of the dangers you faced at the embassy? Just to remind listeners of some of the things that were happening then, people were warned that if they harbored foreigners, they would be executed.
That's right. We received the Iraqis sent around a diplomatic note which said to all embassies that if you're harboring foreigners and you don't bring them down to register them, then we're going to execute you. Now, the registration process would have meant that these Americans, as soon as they showed up at the office, would have been taken hostage. So the question was whether or not you give up your Americans to be held hostage, or you risk being executed by the Iraqi government. And I made that choice rather quickly. I said, and I, to underscore the seriousness with which I took this, I substituted a hangman's noose for a tie in a background press briefing in order to make the point that if Saddam is forcing me to choose between my American citizens and my life, I'll bring my own rope to the hanging. While it was on background and off the record, was just too juicy a story for one of the reporters there. And by noon, the French news stations were saying that the Iraqis were going to execute the American chargé at sundown. The Tariq Aziz, the foreign minister, called a meeting of all the diplomats to basically publicly chastise me for having gone public with this. That didn't work. And so a couple of days later, they withdrew the diplomatic note.
Whose benefit was that symbolic noose for? Who were you trying to send the message to?
Well, the message was to the Iraqis that you really needed to stop this belligerence towards American citizens being held against their will in your country. We had early on decided that given that the chances were pretty good, that some of us would not survive, we adopted a very aggressive posture towards the Iraqi government. We called it the in-your-face strategy. And every time the Iraqis attempted to do something to win propaganda points or to intimidate us, we would turn around and try and flip that back on their shoulders. So, for example, when Saddam came out with this young Stuart Lockwood, this young 14-year-old, and came on international television as Uncle Saddam, treating these hostages kindly, he called them guests. We came out and said that, real Arab knights, because Saddam liked to call himself an Arab knight, don't hide behind the skirts of women or behind little children. And within a couple of days, they agreed to release all the women and children.
So one of the goals is attack his manhood.
Well, one of the goals, the goal was obviously to get all foreigners out. the tactic that we were using was to be very aggressive in our approach towards the Iraqi government. This was not just taking diplomatic notes and depositing them at the foreign ministry. This was a full-blown human rights and civil rights action that we were running. And we succeeded in the end. All the hostages were released. We lost two Americans. One was a businessman who suffered a heart attack early on, and one was an employee at the embassy of who died of a cerebral hemorrhage. Every other American who wanted to get out got out.
Just before you left Iraq, you lowered the flag. And was this lowering, was this like the last time the American flag was up before the end of the war?
That's correct. The day we left, which was on January 12th, we took the flag down because we handed over responsibility for American interests in Iraq to the Polish embassy. And so we took down our flag, the Poles, and raised their flag. And so we symbolically, we brought the flag home with us.
But what did it feel like at that moment, knowing that this was it, you were lowering the flag and taking it with you?
Well, it was terrible. After having worked as hard as we did to both free all Americans, but also trying to resolve the invasion of Kuwait in a way that would have gotten the Iraqis out without our military having to go to war to drive them out, I felt it was a failure of diplomacy. That the next action was going to be a military action. And remember that at the time, we were looking at the possibility of upwards of 50,000 casualties. So one does not look at this with any sort of comfort or any sort of sense of relief. It was terrible anguish.
Let's get back to the interview I recorded earlier this week with Joseph Wilson. His new memoir is called The Politics of Truth. What was it like for you the first time you saw the photo of the captured Saddam Hussein, and when you saw the photo of the dental probe where the doctors were looking in his mouth? And I'm sure that for Saddam Hussein that was a particularly humiliating pose.
Well, I agree with you, and I'm not a big fan of showing things that are, or doing things that are obviously humiliating to somebody, even if it is Saddam Hussein. That said, obviously, I was delighted on behalf of all the Americans who had been held hostage and all the Iraqis who had been abused for so many years to see that this terrible tyrant was out of office, out of power, and in coalition hands. Trust me when I tell you, there is no sense of friendship or respect for somebody like Saddam Hussein. He was a terrible, terrible leader, and deserves any punishment that is coming through him.
Would you have released photos like that?
I don't think so. I think I'm not sure those photos should have been taken. I don't believe they should have been released. I think the abject humiliation of individuals is not something that is consistent with the way that we do business. Certainly not consistent with the Geneva Convention.
You have colleagues and friends around the world, and it sounds like many or most of those colleagues and friends, maybe all of them, are incensed at the story as it slowly becomes revealed about what has happened in Abu Ghraib prison. What are you saying to them to kind of give the point that this doesn't represent what you think should be done, and certainly doesn't represent what most Americans think should be done?
Well, I'm saying just that, and what I'm saying to my own government is that the way that you get this message across to everybody that this is not the America that we all take great pride in, is to assume political accountability and political responsibility for these actions as quickly as possible. That's the only way to begin making amends. Most people are absolutely appalled at these pictures, and one of the problems that we've had really since we embarked upon this adventure is that on September 12th, the day after the Twin Towers came down and the day after the attack on the Pentagon, everybody felt that the attack on us had been an attack on them, because we still were, to most of the world, that shining city on the hill. And whatever people might say about our policies, they still looked at the United States with considerable admiration and respect, and indeed genuine affection for what we represented. How far we have come since then, that now we are looked on as perhaps the greatest threat to global security, and we are increasingly despised and distrusted, mistrusted throughout the world. And we need to get back to that being that city on the hill.
You're in an odd position. You don't trust your government right now either.
Well, I don't trust certain members of my government. I'm certainly in opposition to the policies that have been pursued by this administration, going back to the unilateral abrogating of the Kyoto Accord and the ABM Treaty, and every other thing that they have done to try and weaken a system of collective security, the United Nations, which has held us in good stead for 55, 60 years. Not because the United Nations is perfect, but because if you want to change something and are prepared to destroy it, you really ought to have something to replace it with other than central command in the U.S. military.
Joseph Wilson, thank you very much for talking with us.
That's my pleasure. It's good to be with you.
Joseph Wilson's new memoir is called The Politics of Truth.